The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you with us today. The latest on health and healing in just a moment, including what vitamin C can do that you didn't know that can make you look a lot younger and feel a lot better about yourself. Wonder about that tomato juice. How does it add up against other things as far as being powerful? I'll give you the latest on that. My guest today at the half-hour mark will be Jeffrey Smith. We're going to talk about the health and social needs for protecting all Americans from genetically modified ingredients and food products. Also, there's going to be a march, a 313-mile walk to the White House. I'll be a part of that. It starts this Saturday. We'll be talking about that. So that's my guest. In our issues of the day, we're going to take on two issues that I think are important. And one is student loans. It's $1 trillion. How student debt is killing the economy and punishing an entire generation unfairly so. And then why the food market will be the next bubble to burst. I believe that those in this audience who know what's coming, and it's not that difficult, you can just look ahead and see what we're going to be facing, will now start to put into high gear looking for farmland. All that coming up. Let's begin with latest on health and healing. Vitamin C provides... Oh, and also today, I forgot, I'm continuing and will probably complete my in-depth original investigative report on the safety and efficacy of vaccines. Specifically today, why they should not be calling vaccination immunization. Immunization assumes that your body now has antibodies that are protective lifetime, and therefore when you're exposed to an antigen, you'll be defended. You won't get sick. Nothing could be further from the truth. And this is coming from the peer-reviewed literature in immunology. I'll deal with that today as well. Vitamin C is one of the most well-known and cost-effective and universally beneficial antioxidants that we know of today. Now, this is from Dana Norick of Natural News. Quote, vitamin C topically and internally encourages beautiful skin, helps boost the immune system, and aids in the prevention of several types of cancer. Now, here's the key. One of the ways to have healthier skin, and I've said this so many times, is always to take vitamin C before you go out in the sun. I suggest 1,000 milligrams with 1,000 milligrams of quercetin. I believe in taking the two together. I do. And then I also suggest that you take it after you get back out of the sun, but double that amount, right up to bowel tolerance. So if you take more vitamin C after you're in the sun, with quercetin, you're protecting yourself from sunburn and the damaging effects of the ultraviolet rays. But here's what most people don't appreciate. Vitamin C is a key component of collagen and elastin synthesis in our bodies. And as we know, collagen and elastin are proteins that make up our skin, muscles, and our connective tissue. And collagen essentially creates a foundation for our skin. When it begins to deteriorate with age, we start to see the sagging and wrinkles that are customarily signs of aging. Well, collagen and elastin are the two main reasons our skin remains smooth and resilient in our youth. And elasticity provides the ability to bounce back after repeated movements. And years of facial expressions and exposure to excessive ultraviolet light damages that skin. So when you take in vitamin C, you're actually increasing collagen, you're increasing immunity, you're helping the function of our white blood cells, and you're preventing cancer because you're increasing with vitamin C natural killer cell activity, all of which is important for us. So you want younger skin, younger immune system, healthier immune system, preventing cancer, vitamin C throughout the day. when people, it's fun because last week at a dance party, I was standing under a blaring light to sign people's books. They had come there. It was a wonderful evening. I really enjoyed the energy, the environment, the music, and the dancing. But I spent the first 2 hours signing books. And people come up and look at my skin and say, wow, you don't have a wrinkle. No, there's no reason I should have a wrinkle. First, I don't take anything in that causes inflammation that could lead to degradation of the collagen and excessive free radicals. And secondly, I take an awful lot of antioxidants in powders, in fresh foods, and in capsules to ensure throughout the day that when free radicals are produced, as many as humanly possible can be trapped and neutralized, and therefore protecting the integrity of the collagen and the elastin. So there's no reason for us to have the age damaged skin that we have. No reason at all. Oh yeah, there is. Smoking, drinking, medications, the foods we eat, environmental toxins, all of these can be inflammatory. And that creates the free radicals, that degrades the collagen and elastin, and that prematurely ages you, and especially those of you who have been sun worshippers. Next up, organic tomato juice contains more beneficial phenolic components than juice from conventionally grown crops. This is from the peer reviewed journal Food Chemistry. Let me quote it from Science Daily. This was done, by the way, at the Department of Nutrition and Bromatology of the University of Barcelona. And it was also done at a separate institute as well. It says, organic tomato juice contains more phenolic components than juice from conventionally grown crops. And why is that important? Because I want you to have a lot of different phenolic compounds. The research shows that these phenolic compounds can protect our cells. And phenols are a family of natural compounds with important nutritional properties. They can protect the body against cardiovascular and degenerative disease and some forms of cancer. And these substances neutralize free radicals and are capable of regulating enzyme activity and producing great health benefits. So that's why you want to go organic. And you want a lot of phenolic compounds, like eating grapes. Great phenolic compounds. Fresh-made grape juice. And right now at the farmer's market, you can get fresh, organic Concord grape juice. And it's my favorite grape. I actually grow 4 different types of grapes on vineyards I have on my farm. But and the muscadine, very strong skin on the outside. And very chewy, but delicious on the inside. Tastes very similar to a Concord, but it's very large, size of a large marble. And you don't often see muscadine juice, almost never. But you do see Concord, rich, rich, rich in phenolic compounds. Organic chocolate, rich in phenolic compounds. Cinnamon, same. So get these phenolic compounds. But the difference between organic and non-organic tomato juice, you get more of the healing phenolic compounds. By the way, you can watch today's program by going to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. I've been against synthetic hormone replacement therapy since it was brought onto the market. Every major study has shown that women who take synthetic hormone replacement therapy to alleviate hot flashes and to prevent osteoporosis increase their risk of dying. They also increase the risk of heart attack, stroke, breast cancer, ovarian cancer, dementia, and now add in colorectal cancer. Now we have something else. This is the latest from Science Daily. This is the European Repository Society's, European Respiratory Society's annual congress that just completed this week, and here's what they had to say. Hormone replacement therapy increases the risk of hospitalization from severe asthma attacks. Quote, women taking postmenopausal hormone replacement therapy may have an increased risk of severe asthma attacks requiring hospitalizations. 10 million women in the United States alone take this. we had been able to turn off hot flashes, remineralize bone, improve women's skin, eliminate aging spots, get women to have more muscle mass, less fat, all of this, and more energy, all without any hormone replacement therapy. Natural methods to prevent and treat kidney stones. People get kidney stones. I believe that one of the most painful things a person could ever have is the excruciating pain from passing a kidney stone. Sometimes people go to the hospital because it's so bad. But what causes these kidney stones in the first place? And why are they finding it more and more difficult to eliminate these? Because of our highly acidic diets. That's where you develop kidney stones. You do not see this at the same rate in highly alkaline diets that help prevent this kind of deposit. Now, where do you get this acidic diet? It's simple. Soft drinks, coffee, acidic foods, corn syrup, alcohol, animal proteins, especially with arachidonic acid, pork and beef, hamburgers, hot dogs, pork chops. That's where you get your highly acidic foods. And that creates an environment that encourages kidney stones. And so what do? Well, you want to take in the vegetables that are alkalizing, and green tea is good, but also your berries, blueberries, raspberries, strawberries, tart cherries, cranberries, pomegranates, papaya, very good, pineapple, very good, all good. And then your grains, rye, quinoa, those are alkalizing. And that can help you. Vitamin C also helps prevent kidney stones from forming. And finally, prevent cancer by reducing inflammation, insulin, and infections. This is from Connie Strachine of Natural News. I'll quote this. Inflammation, infections, and excessive levels of insulin, that means high blood sugar-caused insulin, in the body are major instigators of cancer. Often they occur together, and most people in modern society suffer from some degree of all three. Yet it is possible to reduce their influence upon the body and therefore dramatically lower cancer risk. Inflammation can cause cancer because it generates free radicals and damaged DNA and creates cell mutations which lead to cancer. Many things cause inflammation: refined sugars, pasteurized dairy products, polyunsaturated oils, charred, overcooked, and processed foods, genetically modified organisms, pesticides, artificial food additives like MSG. And since allergies cause inflammation, common food allergens such as peanuts, soy, and gluten can be cancer-causing if a person is allergic to them. Environmental toxins like mercury, electromagnetic radiation, and industrial chemicals also cause inflammation, as do infections. So all this can cause damage to the DNA, and that's how we end up with cancer. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'm looking at the clock. We're going to go to our guest in about 15 minutes. Welcome everybody who's on board, and just a couple of things. And I want to go to our special report and continue on giving insight and information on vaccines. The entire article, with all of the scientific peer-reviewed literature as references, because I'm only using their statistics and their analysis to make this argument, and pulling all these disparate points together for this argument is what hasn't been done. Part one is already up there. It shows you the fraud of Gardasil. There's no proof it protects against these cancers, especially in young women. And it was only hypothetical at the time, and yet it was immediately marketed, made mandatory that young girls get this. Well, now young girls, some as young as 9, are getting it, yet it was never tested in those young women. And there's over 24,000 very serious adverse effects. Thousands of women end up in the hospital. Over 100 have died. So we're dealing with an extremely serious dilemma. The vaccine doesn't work. There's no proof it does, but it does cause injury, does cause hospitalization, does cause death. Now, what if we could prove, which we should have proved to begin with, that vaccines are not effective at creating immunization? They didn't prove that vaccines create immunization in every single person, lifetime immunization, with no adverse effects. And if you can't prove that, then what exactly is the purpose for taking them? Let me continue with our series now. This is called Changing the Paradigm. Are we crippling our immune systems? Now, I'm going to be doing a little bit of technical discussion, but I'll always explain it in lay language. Since widespread vaccination programs against these diseases began in the 1980s and 90s, there tend to be fewer outbreaks of illness, but the illnesses are more severe and unexpected. Despite the reduced number of cases, proportionally more of these lead to serious illnesses and death. Now, if you remember yesterday, I said that in a group of down in Texas, every one of the people who came down with the disease had been fully vaccinated, but then they come down with a more severe form of the disease. Then those people who were not immunized got the measles and got over it. Now they have lifetime immunity. And also, no vaccine has been shown to give lifetime immunity to any given individual. And the demographics have completely changed, and this is startling. Instead of 7 to 10-year-olds getting the mumps, it is teenagers who are currently the most affected. And likewise, instead of the same 7 to 10-year-olds getting the measles, that's the traditionally affected age group for decades, many of the current patients are infants who are much more likely to die from infection with the virus. Measles is especially hazardous in infants because of the risk of complications. And between a quarter and a third develop some related problem like diarrhea, ear infections, pneumonia, or the deadly encephalitis, which can kill an infant. Numerous studies and peer-reviewed literature have examined this finding and reached the same conclusion. Women who became mothers since the mandate of the measles vaccine did not get measles as a child, and thus do not have solid immunity to pass on to their babies through their breast milk or in utero. Vaccinated women are found to significantly have fewer antibodies against measles than women who were not immunized, who got measles, and now they have natural immunity. And infants born to vaccinated mothers have lower antibody concentrations at birth and faster decay of antibodies than infants born to women with natural immunity. Now, CDC figures show how mandated childhood vaccines has changed the face of measles. In 1976, just 3% of all cases occurred in children under age 1. Typically, their mothers were born in the 1950s, well before the measles vaccine became routinely available a decade later. In the 1980s, as teenagers who were vaccinated as children began to have babies, those numbers started to change. In 1985, almost 8% of measles cases were in infants younger than 1 year of age. By 1991, it had climbed to 19%. And by 2002, 28% of all measles cases in the United States occurred in babies under a year of age. This is unprecedented. Clearly, this shows that the mothers who had historically had measles and had natural immunity passed on the right antibodies to their children, who then were protective. Now, women who did not develop measles but were vaccinated for the measles are passing on very weak antibodies, and that's why their babies are coming down with measles, and that can be deadly. Babies used to be protected from disease through maternal antibodies, but this wonderful mechanism of the human immune system is being destroyed by vaccines. If we remain on the current trajectory of exponentially increasing the number and types of vaccines given to both children and now to adults, we will reach a point where we will no longer have normal immunity at all, thus becoming completely dependent upon short-lived, meager vaccine immunity for our very survival against disease. But why aren't vaccines more immunogenic? The process of creating a vaccine involves taking a diseased agent, and rendering it gradually weaker and weaker, so that the body's own immune response is triggered and antibodies are made. That's known as humoral immunity. But there is more to the immune system than that portion that is triggered and targeted by the vaccine manufacturers. In addition to humoral immunity, which relies on antibodies, there is also cell-mediated immunity, which does not. Cell-mediated immunity involves the activation of macrophages and natural killer cells and antigen-specific cytotoxic T lymphocytes and the release of various cytokines in response to an antigen. What is lacking in our current method of vaccination is a way to stimulate the entire immune response instead of just a portion of it. Normal exposure to pathogens always begins in the nasal, ear, throat, and respiratory passages, never through injection. Once primary immunity has been established by infection, we actually get the condition, the antibody response follows. This allows the immune system to grow stronger and learn to bestow natural and permanent immunity to an ever-increasing number of pathogens. Vaccines injected into the body bypass cell-mediated immunity and overstimulate humoral immunity. This confuses the normal maturation and skews the functioning of the immune system. Humoral immunity becomes dominant, and the crucial cell-mediated immunity is suppressed. The result can be autoimmune disease and frequent infections. Research shows that vaccinated children compared with unvaccinated children suffer 500% more asthma, 300% more allergies, 300% more ear infections, and 400% more recurring tonsillitis. We have tricked the immune system into not mounting an all-out response to a foreign agent. According to Dr. Zinkernagel at the University Hospital of Zurich, Institute for Experimental Immunology, quote, "We have not succeeded in generating truly protective vaccines against persisting infections because we cannot imitate infection immunity that is long-lasting, generating protective TMB cell stimulation against variable infections without causing disease by either immunopathology or tolerance," unquote. Now, that's extremely important. Mind you, this is one of the leading immunologists in the world telling us that vaccines don't create the same protective immunity as natural immunity does, and can't, but will cause disease. So now disease outbreaks create panic and fear when they occur, followed by rage against the irresponsible patient or parent who don't vaccinate their children for having created the problem. The argument from the pro-vaccine camp is that there wouldn't be any cases of measles at all if every child were vaccinated. Well, as I've shown you yesterday, that clearly is not the case. None of their arguments, none of them, can stand up to real scrutiny. Let's explain something again. There is a difference between efficiency and effectiveness. The real gold standard of scientific study requires a double-blind, placebo-controlled, randomized trial to isolate the effects of one particular intervention. In order to evaluate vaccines properly, it would be necessary for vaccine makers to take every vaccine on the market and compare a group of vaccinated children with a group of unvaccinated children under the same conditions to ascertain whether vaccines were effective in providing lasting immunity. This type of study has never been done, nor has a retrospective analysis of vaccinated versus unvaccinated individuals been undertaken. And why not? The possible result might be that we find that we have sold a bill of goods about the long-term immunity of effectiveness of vaccines. Now, that does not mean that some children and adults unvaccinated will not come down with a disease and get sick, or even some will die. Yes, they will and have. But until you take 10,000 children who have never received a vaccine and follow them for 6 years, cross-match them in gender, age, weight, and health circumstances, and give them fully vaccinated programs, and then measure them, you will never know what the truth is. Now, there is some truth, because we have seen that that you don't have autism and any statistical numbers in the Amish and the Mennonites who are not vaccinated. Well, isn't it interesting? In one large group, we're talking about thousands and thousands of children, we couldn't find any autism disorders, and yet there were a few children that had them. Guess what? They were adopted children who had been vaccinated. But they never talk about this. Instead, we have clinical trials in which individuals are vaccinated and success is measured by attaining a certain antibody titer in the blood. The protective level is arbitrarily assigned by the researcher. So if enough vaccinated subjects attain a designated level of antibodies, the vaccine is proclaimed to have efficacy. But is this the same as being effective? No. To be truly effective, a vaccine would have to prevent disease, but effectiveness is never put to the test. Only did they reach a certain titer in their blood. The problem with proving efficacy is that antibody levels do not necessarily correlate with immune system's ability to fight off disease. One rare prospective study, which attempted to evaluate this issue as it relates to vaccinating the elderly with the flu vaccine, found that pre- and post-vaccine antibody titers, whether high or low, did not distinguish between subjects who would subsequently develop the flu, whether vaccinated or not, so it was not protective. How can we know if a vaccine will work or not prior to being released to the public? We can't. According to an article in the peer-reviewed Journal of Infectious Disease, since it is too difficult to prove effectiveness, the only way to try to evaluate vaccines is to scrutinize the epidemiological data obtained from real-life conditions. In other words, researchers simply cannot or will not adequately test a vaccine's effectiveness and immunogenicity prior to its release onto an unsuspecting public. The true testing occurs after the fact. Only instead of surveillance, it is more likely that a vaccine manufacturer will try to keep all adverse reactions and evidence of vaccine's failure or harm from the public. The party line is always that since actual results occur outside the limits of a clinical study, they are not reliable. I'm Gary Knoll. That's what we have today. Tomorrow I will continue, and I'll get into more lies about the effectiveness of vaccines and why they should be challenged. And I might mention that in persons with AIDS, that I had numerous times, I had people who had zero T cells, the so-called gold standard for determining if someone would survive or not. If you had low T cells, you were supposed to die. I had people reversed AIDS. All AIDS-defining illnesses were completely healthy. Their blood chemistry showed perfection. No infections, no inflammation, no diseases at all. And if they had no T cells, low T cells. So, once again, they were wrong on what they were measuring. The same as what they're wrong now. If you had a titer of a particular antibody after being vaccinated, it does not mean that you, as an individual, can be guaranteed that that titer will protect you by giving you natural immunization throughout your life and keep you safe. There is no guarantee for any given individual for lifetime immunity protection of a vaccine and safety from that same vaccine. Hence, we are dealing in the worst of all possible sciences. I'm Gary Knoll, back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. In about 5 minutes from now, when he calls in, we'll be listening to Jeffrey Smith, who is here to lead us, along with Vandana Shiva and many others, on a march, a 300-mile march, 313-mile march, to the White House to protest genetically modified seeds. I'll be a part of that march. I'll be filming it. By the way, I can use some volunteers who would like to be helping, because I've got to be in two locations. I'm going to be a keynote speaker at an anti-nuclear rally with Helen Caldicott this Saturday, and I've got to be on Prospect Park for this. Thank goodness my lecture is later in the day, and I'll be over there filming and interviewing people for the march. If you can help, we're going to need several people, because I'm going to have a big camera crew with me. Just call the number 626-926-5422, and give them your name and phone number. Someone will call you back. Also, this Saturday, at Sunday, this coming Sunday, at my Uptown Whole Foods at 89th and Broadway, you can meet Denise Ortega and her family. They are going to have a homesteading day, and you will see what one person was able to achieve in under a year. From her retirement from the New York City Police Department with her husband, both retired, she has now created an entire food line, cosmetic line, almost 100 products. I've been testing them. I've been giving them feedback. They are as good as they can get. She and her family have a future. They'll be moving to a homestead. They'll be networking. But how you do this is what people should know. I know a lot of you would like to do this and would like to see what you could do if you chose to do a homesteading. So it's your chance to go there, talk with her, look at her products, and see what you could do for yourself. That's this Sunday, 1 p.m. till 6 p.m. at 89th and Broadway at Gary's Uptown Whole Foods. One final program announcement before we go to our guest and your calls. I'll open the line up for a few calls at 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888 on any of the issues you find important is this. For the past 7 years, I had the great privilege of being a part of WMYE, the official radio station of the City of New York. But I'm also on a lot of other radio stations, and right now we have 3 just in New York City alone, all at noon. So what we are doing, we are going to be leaving WMYE. This Friday will be our last day. And I'm encouraging those people to go to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. That's something that we are going, it is growing in numbers you cannot believe. And you can download any show. I realize not everyone has a internet access. So for those of you who do not, you can go over and listen as of Monday on WBAI at 99.5 FM. It has a stronger signal. And hopefully a more progressive series of programs coming up that you can align to. George Galloway, a lot of good shows there. In McMaster's, etc. Anyhow, this Friday, last day on WMYE, 99.5 FM, I want to thank all the people. We went to number one on the station. In fact, we were not on number one on the station. We exceeded the entire morning from 6 a.m. to noon in the size of our audience. The management of the station has been terrific. They have never once called and made an issue of any of the controversial topics we deal with. We deal with hard-hitting topics. They've been extraordinarily supportive. So kudos, my highest regard for the management, the staff of WMYE. We'll be signing off there because we simply have too many programs. We're on simultaneously. It confuses people, and we have to do separate streams off that, and those are very costly streams to do. So we're limiting down to less in each market. We're all over the world now. And most importantly, if you have access to the computer, listen live on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. If you don't have that, as of Monday, listen live at noon to 99.5 FM. 99.5 FM. I've been on WBAI now for 28 years and 7 months, October 15th. So you won't be able to hear us any longer on WMYE. Now, let's take some calls. Let's say hello to Paul from St. Louis. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Hey, Gary. How you doing today?
Always excellent. Had a great overnight show, 6 hours on KPFK, our sister station in Los Angeles, where I've been on for almost 28 years every Wednesday morning for 6 hours. And a great group of people out there and other people listening around the United States. But we're glad you're calling in from St. Louis. How can we help you?
Well, I have a question that I think a lot of people may be thinking about also. You have doctors like Dr. Esselstein, Dr. McDougall, Dr. Ornish, all these doctors that are doing such great work helping people with their cholesterol, with their heart health, and their overall health. But the one thing that they all seem to agree on is that olive oil, fish oil, they're like a chest pain in a bottle, they say, or a heart attack in a bottle. Bad for cholesterol, and they all seem to say no oils of any kind,
okay,
olive oil.
All right, let me address this because we have our guest standing by, Paul, but it's a very legitimate question. You have not heard Dr. McDougall on my program for years, yet at one time I invited him on with regularity, and helped him launch his career within the larger holistic community. In other words, exposing him to a lot of people he wouldn't have had exposure to. I have been there for Dean Ornish. I was filming Dean Ornish. I had him on. He and I debated together on PBS on the better type of diet. I have a lot of respect for Dean Ornish, and I have respect for Dr. McDougall. We share difference of opinions, however, on how complete a program should be. I do not believe in the idea that we should reduce or eliminate the oils in the diet. And since I have a background in clinical nutrition, I am a PhD in human nutrition and public health science. I'm a professor at the University of Fairleigh Dickinson in the same sciences and a research fellow for 30 years at the Institute of Biology and Anti-Aging Medicine. And I've done over 47 clinical studies, human clinical studies, including presenting them for International Symposium. I'm able to get feedback from other people in the field who use this work and then say it worked or didn't work. So you're getting constant feedback when you're putting your information out, even on the radio. And it is my opinion, studying the scientific literature and having a lot of clinical experience, seeing a lot of patients, that the quality of the oils you give someone is directly proportional to the health of that person's cardiovascular system. And the greatest evidence of this are two studies, the two largest studies done. One is are on the Mediterranean diets. That they have a very rich fatty diet. They do not have a zero diet. But the fish they have are generally wild fish. The oil they get is from olives, but it's an organic, premium extra virgin olive oil, meaning it has low acidity. It is always first press. It is a sweeter oil, and it's more alkalizing. Now, when you combine, and the studies show this, when you combine the oil of olives and the oil of fish, you increase the benefits of the omega-3 fatty acids greater than either of those separately, and that turns off inflammation. It helps with the turn-off inflammation in the brain. It helps turn off inflammation in the lungs and the heart, and you actually reduce coronary artery disease. You have very low coronary artery disease in the Mediterranean, one of the lowest rates in the world and one of the longest-lived people in the world. In fact, as a specific point, it is tied, is Crete. Now, I have been to the Mediterranean. I've been to all the countries there. I've studied the diet. I've gone into the villages, into the mountains. I've spent time in the farms and many times. And I go there specifically for that. And I don't know if the others have done so. But there's nothing like meeting with people who are in their 90s or hundreds who are vital, healthy, because they have functioning mitochondria, good circulation, and then you examine how they live, their attitudes, their beliefs, their pace of life, and you see that the oils and fats in the diet are essential. They eat a lot of walnuts, that's fats. They eat almonds, fats, macadamia nuts, fats. They have grains and legumes which have low fat. They have some dairy, and the way it cheeses, that's fat. So to make any statement that fats in the diet are contributing to heart disease is to oversimplify it. In point of fact, unhealthy fats contribute to heart disease, clogging the arteries, inflammation, and the bad LDL cholesterol, and increasing our triglycerides. Good fats do just the opposite. Coconut oil, I can show you 100 studies on the benefits of coconut oil, a saturated fat, but one that is antiviral, antibacterial, is great for helping the epithelial tissue, and so it is the quality of the fat, its form that you take it in, and the percentage. And I see a different approach. Now, I respect their ability to share what they believe is important to them, but I consider most of those people monotheistic, meaning they found something they could become famous on, and they stick with it. And by the way, Linus Pauling was a friend of mine. He used to come over at the Institute in the evening. We would sit there and have long conversations. I could never get him to take quercetin to enhance the bioavailability of vitamin C, and he only took ascorbic acid. When I told him if I gave straight ascorbic acid instead of a buffered ascorbate to individuals, they'd get diarrhea or upset stomach. But he was adamant. So in his world, the only American to ever win two unsure Nobel Prizes, we disagreed on the form or the way vitamin C should be taken. When I showed him people who had reversed hepatitis, BNC, herpes, 1, 2, and 6, and AIDS-defining illnesses, and the protocols, not the least of which was giving very high levels of intravenous vitamin C, he was bowled over by it, but he never took that forward. So we must understand that everyone in the field can come up with something that's important, a contributing piece of the puzzle. Let us not, however, be confused that if we stop our growth and stop our determination to seek a way of deconstructing our own arguments, then we're locked in. And my final point is, when I came down to one of our Monday meetings at the Institute, and I just finished this major study, it had taken almost a year and a half. I had one group of 1,000 rats that were given the normal rat chow, kept in the normal little cages, the little tiny boxes, and that's how they were dealt with. Another 1,000 rats from the same litters were kept upstairs where there were no cages. They were running all over the place. I did a very creative environment. They were given organic foods. I gave them juices. I made fresh juices. And if you came in at night, you would see rats all over the place, including ones that were my favorites. They would come up and sit on my shoulders, on my head. It would freak people out. Those rats did not live a year. They lived a year and 3 months. That was the first time that study had ever been done. And when I originally took it down to present this information, the first thing the director of the Institute said was, he said, "Now, go disprove yourself." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, you're telling us something you believe is true. Now show us why it's not true, not accurate, where you've made mistakes, where you've been self-serving in your arguments, where you've skewed your study." So I went back, and it took months. I tried everything. And then I brought in some other people to try to discredit my work. When we couldn't discredit it, I finally went back and I said, "Here's all that we did to disprove what I did." He said, "Good. Now we can go forward with that." What you don't see today are people who are macrobiotics, raw foodists, people who have a particular concept of hygiene or life or belief that they're willing to challenge. It becomes almost a cult-like belief to them that all their truth is being a Democrat, a Republican, or a Tea Party, or some other belief system, or Keynesian economics. They're not willing to challenge it. And in life, if you're not willing to deconstruct the challenges you have, then you're locked into a very limited perspective. So I believe that a lot of people would be a lot further along in helping people as they had if they'd be more open-minded, more flexible, get their ego out of their equations, and go forward. I have a lot of respect for these people. Nothing on the downside. It's just I believe they could do a lot more on the upside. Hope that answers your question. Paul from St. Louis. Now let's immediately go over to my guest who is standing by. He is Jeffrey Smith, one of the foremost experts on the health and environmental risks of genetically modified organisms, commonly referred to as GMOs, and he is leading a watchdog effort to stop the FDA, the USDA, our Congress, from rubber stamping that these crops, these genetically engineered crops and the science behind them are good for us, don't need to be labeled, and they should be sponsored, subsidized, and promoted. He is the author of two books, Seeds of Deception and Genetic Roulette. And he is here also to lead people in a 313-mile walk to White House. I'll be there with my camera crew to interview people and to support his efforts on Saturday at Prospect Park. Nice to have you with us today, Jeffrey.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Jeffrey, please give us your insights and overview on... First, Europe and Japan have laws for labeling GMOs. Other countries plan to follow suit. The food industry and government's refusal to have foods containing GMOs labeled in the United States, I feel, is a disgrace. What is the basis for their denial, improperly informing the consumers to make decisions on what they want to eat and avoid? And finally, what are the main things you believe the federal government wants to hide from the public regarding GMOs and factory farm foods? The forum is yours.
Great questions. Yes, the right to know, the demand for labeling is in fact the basis for this march from New York to Washington, which starts at 11 a.m. at the Prospect Park Grand Army Plaza in Brooklyn on Saturday. People, by the way, can meet at the Flatbush Co-op at 10 a.m. and then march to the Grand Army Plaza. And I'll be there speaking along with many others. There's actually about 50 countries that require labeling of GMOs, but not the United States. And this comes back to the mandate by the White House, starting in early 90s and continuing till today, to the FDA to promote biotechnology. In fact, a former commissioner of the FDA, Lester Crawford, had given a PowerPoint presentation to the dairy industry, and on the slide it said the goals of the FDA is to help vouchsafe the safety of food and drugs and to promote biotechnology. So it's not just a subtle theme, it is very overt. So they know that most Americans, 53% according to a New York Times poll, say they would avoid GMOs if they were labeled. And 90 or 95% of Americans want GMOs labeled. But because the labeling of GMOs, if made as a requirement, would eliminate GMOs from the food supply, because no one in their right mind would label something where most Americans would avoid it if labeled, the FDA ignores 9 out of 10 Americans in order to support the economic interests of 5 biotech companies. Now, what are they hiding? That's also something we can even go into the FDA records to find. They claimed on their policy, which exists today, which was released in 1992, they claimed that the agency is not aware of any information showing that GMOs were significantly different. This was a lie. We know it's a lie because 44,000 secret internal memos from the FDA's files were made public from a lawsuit in 1998, and it showed that the overwhelming consensus among the FDA's own scientists was exactly the opposite as presented in the policy. So what are those lies? What is it that they're trying to hide? They're trying to hide, for example, that the scientists said that GMOs might create allergens, toxins, new diseases, and nutritional problems. They're trying to hide the fact that the Center for Veterinary Medicine director, Gerald Geist, said that GMOs in animal feed might pose specific health harm for those that eat the meat or drink the milk. Obviously, toxins can bioaccumulate in animals. They said that GMOs might accumulate toxins from the environment, which we're seeing now in the Roundup Ready and other herbicide-tolerant crops, which draw these herbicides into the food portion and are fed to us on our plates and are now linked to birth defects, reproductive disorders, and cancer. And so they've been hiding the entire scientific basis of concern, which drove their scientists to recommend over and over again that GMOs should be tested carefully. Instead, the FDA says no testing is necessary whatsoever, no labeling is necessary. In fact, companies like Monsanto, who told us that PCBs, Agent Orange, and DDT were safe, can determine if their GMOs are safe and put them on the market without any safety studies required whatsoever. Now, the EPA looks at products like pesticide-producing corn and cotton and label those plants as registered pesticides, but they only look at a tiny portion of the GM crop, which is wholly insufficient, and they allow BT toxin, an insecticide, to be produced in every cell of the corn plant and fed to us. Now, what they're trying to hide are the fact that their assumptions that allowed them to approve this BT toxin-producing corn are completely false. They said that the BT toxin does not affect mammals or humans. They ignore the peer-reviewed published studies that show hundreds of people got allergic or flu-like symptoms. Some had to go to the hospital when sprayed with the natural BT derived from soil bacteria. They ignored the fact that when BT in its natural state was fed to mice, they had tissue damage and immune system responses. Now we're seeing with BT plants, which is producing thousands of times more concentrated a toxin, it's designed to be more toxic, we're seeing the same kind of allergic and flu-like symptoms among the Indian farm workers picking that BT cotton in India. We're seeing the high immune system responses in mice that were fed the BT corn by a Italian government study, and even in Monsanto's own study, which they claim shows that there's no problem, when the raw data was reevaluated by independent scientists, they showed signs of toxicity and immune system eruption. So what they're trying to hide basically is everything about GMOs, and now the WikiLeaks has just confirmed what we've known all along, that the entire State Department infrastructure is basically an enforcement wing for Monsanto around the world. They actually have sent back cables saying, after meeting with the director of Monsanto in the region and et cetera, we would like you to promote GMOs, put pressure on Brussels, put a retaliation list against countries that are trying to resist GMOs. We're supporting or acknowledging the efforts of illegal cultivation of GMOs in Romania. We're trying to get media from Ecuador to send to St. Louis so they can be brainwashed by Monsanto. It's a complete full-court press on the world based on the misinformation that GMOs are going to somehow improve U.S. exports and increase U.S. domination of the food supply, which was the reason why the White House originally told the FDA to promote biotechnology, but the exact opposite happened. And we ended up spending $3 to $5 billion per year in propping up the prices of the GM crops no one wanted. We lost our corn exports to Europe. Now we find that the GM crops are contaminating honey. And most recently, and I think you know this, that in Sherbrooke University in Canada, they tested the blood of mothers and infants, or unborn fetuses, and found in 93% of the pregnant moms and 80% of the unborn fetuses, the BT toxin that was created by Monsanto's corn. It's designed to break open the stomach of insects and kill them. And the EPA has said for years, don't worry, it's safe. It's destroyed completely by the digestive process. It'll never show up in the blood. Well, guess what? It's there in large numbers. So these are the kind of things that we're concerned about. This is the kind of things that caused the American Academy of Environmental Medicine to say all doctors should prescribe non-GMO diets. And this is one of the reasons why people all over the country now are not just rallying on a march to D.C., which again starts on Saturday at Prospect Park at 11, but also there's rallies all over the country. There's GM-free groups happening all over the country. October 16th is World Food Day, and there's going to be a rally in front of the White House as well as events all over the country. And so what we're seeing now is a kind of like the Earth's immune system or the U.S. immune system rising up against this toxification of our food supply through GMOs, and we're now demanding to know which foods are GM and non-GM so we can choose healthier non-GMO brands.
Good. One other thing here. From Science Daily, it says, published in the Journal of Agriculture on Resource Economics, this was a study from Iowa State University, Wallace Huffman, quote, consumers are eager to get their hands on and teeth into foods that are genetically modified to increase health benefits and even pay more for the opportunity. That's what the study said. And it says that the study shows that when consumers are presented with produce enhanced with consumer traits through intragenic means, they will pay significantly more than for plain produce. So for me, this shows that the consumer is being misled by the lies of the genetic engineering groups with the belief that somehow genetic engineered food will be better for them. And not just one quick, before you answer that, for those of you listening, if you are, your station is going to be going offline in a moment, where you can continue to listen on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. For those of you who would like to volunteer with cars or vans, because we're going to have a whole crew of camera people for the march to Washington and filming Jeffrey and everyone over there, so we can show it to our audience. Call Jason at 646-926-5428. 646-926-5428. We have no more room for tonight's health support meeting. No more room. Don't call. Now, Jeffrey, would you respond to that study?
Sure. I'll also mention that Right to Know March, and the word 2 is spelled as the number 2, righttoknowmarch.org, has all the information for Saturday's launch and for the 16-day, 313-mile march to Washington. Now, this is an example of a misdirection, both in terms of the study and in terms of its reporting. The actual study showed that when they pointed to transgenic foods, where genes are transferred from one species to another, there was no way they could convince the subjects to say that they were good. It was only by saying, all we did was put genes in from the same species that naturally belong there, and we've enhanced certain things in a completely safe way, would you like it then? And so they downplayed the fact that when you, even when you insert a species' own genes, it still causes massive collateral damage. It can still increase toxins and allergen, and has in some laboratory studies. They completely misdirect, and even though the study itself showed that GMOs, as produced now, transgenic, where genes are transferred between kingdoms, even though that was rejected by the subjects in that experiment, the pro-GMO editors and writers of this piece ignored that and led with a statement saying consumers want GMOs. It reminds me of the study that was done in a farm store in Canada, where they put an article out, they put an article in a UK journal saying that when given proper information that's neutral, consumers want non-GMO, want GMO corn, not non-GMO corn. But it turns out that someone from the Globe and Mail had visited that farm study, had taken a picture, and hanging above the non-GMO corn was a sign that said, would you buy wormy sweet corn? Would you buy wormy sweet corn? And listed all these pesticides and herbicides that were sprayed. And above the GM corn, they said, they basically gave a complete misinformation campaign about why it was safe and better. They had literature out there that was basically pro-GMO, and the person who was running the study actually would stop people who bought the non-GM and convince them to buy the GM, and did that for the reporter from the Globe and Mail to demonstrate. And this was not reported in the peer-reviewed published study, so it was described, when it was revealed, many independent scientists called the paper of fraud. It had won the award for the best paper of the year, and the editor and publisher refused to withdraw the paper or withdraw the award, and simply allowed the edit, the writer of the article, to put some kind of blabbering about why it actually was neutral and it was okay for him not to include all this collateral material that was forcing consumers to think that non-GMO was bad. So it's the kind of disinformation that we see on consumer levels, but it gets much more dangerous when we look at the actual safety studies. There we see they'll ignore animal death, they'll ignore animal organ changes, they'll cause distortion and disinformation. I mean, we have seen damage to virtually every system and every organ studied in laboratory animals, and yet the biotech industry uses the wrong detection method, the wrong statistical method, the wrong control groups. They overcook samples, they dilute samples, they completely ignore data and leave it out of studies that are recovered later. So that when only it takes a kind of a detective work to put all these together to show that it's pure tobacco science and it's not something we should be basing our health on.
I appreciate that answer. Thank you. And I look forward to being over there to give support to this cause. And as you know, we're doing a major documentary. You were filmed last year for it. And we're going to be presenting that a little later this year. By the way, did you get a copy of our Knocking on the Devil's Door yet?
Yes, we did. Thank you. And I've been traveling for weeks and weeks, and it's sitting in a stack by our DVD player. I'm looking forward to seeing it.
Well, Vandana Shiva, yes, was in New York last Wednesday, and he lectured on that. We look forward to her being there and being a guiding light, along with Francis Moore LePay, Michael Hansen, senior scientist for the Consumers Union, and many others. And hopefully people from this audience will join Jeffrey Smith, Vandana Shiva, Francis Moore LePay, Michael Hansen, and all those who care about challenging our right of freedom of choice. If people want genetically engineered foods, that's a right. But those of us who don't want it, we want to know, by label and by instruction, is this genetically modified or not? Right now, we don't know that. So please come at 11 a.m. this Saturday, October 1st, to the Grand Army Plaza in Prospect Park in Brooklyn for the rally, and then the beginning of that walk to Washington. And we'll be in that walk. We'll be in Washington, too, filming. And then also on October 3rd at 11 a.m. at the Autumn Harvest Health Food at East 2nd Street in Scotch Plains, on October 3rd at 4 p.m. at George Street Co-op Natural Foods in Morris Street in New Brunswick, New Jersey, and at a rally at October 4th, 2 p.m. at Whole Earth Center on Nassau Street in Princeton. For more information, go to righttoknowmarch.org. And Jeffrey's book is Genetic Roulette, The Documented Health Risks of Genetically Engineered Food. Jeffrey, all the best to you and all the good work you've put in to make this happen and informing the public.
Great. great. And by the way, you can come at 10 a.m. to the Flatbush Co-op to march to the Grand Army Plaza, and I look forward to seeing you on Saturday.
We'll be there, always there to support you and your good efforts.
Thank you so much.
I'm Gary Noll. I want to thank all of you for taking your time, and if you have not downloaded and listened to the three-hour program from Monday night's program on deconstructing the myths, the lies, and the cover-ups of the 9/11 official report, please do so. It was all based upon forensic information from a large panel of experts who have something to say, and we provided the forum for them to say it. It's yours now to listen to. Go to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, go to the archives, and listen to Monday evening's Progressive Commentary Hour. Have a nice day, everyone.
Gary Noll Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matthew Bogart. All shows are archived by Kyle Pollard. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride. And the program director is Jason Tappenfeld.